This morning, I wanted to say a few words about how the Buddhist tradition presents the idea of happiness, and to some extent, how this might relate to the idea of self or anatta in the Pali, not self. And I'll do that by way of sharing a small grouping of related phrases from the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada is one of my favorite texts, and it seems to, though being a small text, and depending on the translation, relatively easy to digest. I think we could argue it contains the whole of the Dharma. Everything seems to somehow be in there. To begin, and I suspect many of you have heard this before, if by renouncing a lesser happiness, one may realize a greater happiness, let the wise person renounce the lesser, having regard for the greater. So there seems to be levels, maybe, that the Buddha, at the time of his teaching, and of course the teachers who followed and the commentators who were reflecting on what he initially taught orally, they seem to be tracking levels and a possibility almost of graduating into something that is achievable yet maybe subtle and not something that everybody has access to. I would argue that it's something that can be obtained by anyone, and that all of us have various obstacles that are getting in the way of that. And in this short passage, it seems to me there's also an insinuation almost of choice. We can choose, in a sense, to live our lives immersed in what in this translation was referred to as a lesser or lower happiness, or we can choose something else. Let the wise person renounce the lesser, having regard for the greater. So becoming interested in something else. So what is being advocated for is a particular way of perceiving and relating to life and relating to our own mind and body, such that we begin to expand our capacity to connect with, understand, and embody ultimately a kind of innate well-being, a kind of innate well-being. So there's this latent potential. There's an inherent capacity that seems to be available to us. And yet, even as practitioners, sometimes when we're practicing, do you ever have the sense that, like, there's a little bit more peace or a little bit more quiet, and it's just you're so close, but something's in the way? Do you have that feeling sometimes, right? It's a very common, even as the practice matures, maturation of practice is a little bit wobbly when we're paying it. There's this sense of, oh, you know, this is a new state of calm, or this is a new state of concentration, or I'm realizing that I'm bringing these skills back into my life, and there's this sense of going somewhere, like the practice is working. And then at the same time, because we're becoming more self-aware, we're less inclined to deluding ourselves. We also see how, oh, there's something in the way at the same time. There's more quiet, there's more stillness, and usually the mind is occupied in some way, and we haven't moved beyond that. So this notion of latency, if you will, can be understood alongside the Dhamma's notion of bhavana, or to cultivate, right? So bhavana combines the intention to develop the mind and the activities used to support that intention. The central practice, of course, being meditation. So, as you know, as folks who have chosen to come here and for whom this is probably not the only place or time of meditation, this is an active path in a way, right? There's sitting and being quiet and still. Though anyone who has meditated long enough understands that it takes quite a bit of effort. And then we have, as I mentioned earlier, we have these groupings, these short, pithy phrases that seem to work together to create a whole image. And I'd like to share a few of these with you. Better it is. There's quite a lot of opinion in these teachings. Though folks who cultivate their mind tend not to disagree, right? Better it is to live one day wise and meditative than to live 100 years foolish and uncontrolled. Better it is to live one day wise and meditative than to live 100 years foolish and uncontrolled. This is a very strong statement. Right? In 100 years, that phrase used in the teachings is referring to a whole lifetime, or as long as we live. And we really can spend quite a lot of time sort of undirected in our lives, or in relationship to goals, or without goals, or in the language of the Dhamma, propelled forward unconsciously by our conditioned response to life, right? It's this sense of meditation is not about control in the conventional sense, but it is about gaining a grip on the lack of control we have when we are simply unconsciously moving about and responding to life based on learned habits, accumulated habits that have not been investigated and determined by our discernment or some kind of discriminating awareness. To be either helpful or unhelpful, skillful or unskillful. So this idea of control is not about manipulation or power over anything or anyone other than a kind of power over one's own conditioning, so that there becomes a capacity for choice, right? Sometimes when asked, what is the Dharma, a teacher will say an appropriate response. So to have control is to have the ability to respond appropriately to life, rather than habitually to life. So how could just one day, you know, be better? And the idea is ultimately that there's such a profound level of satisfaction that comes through presence alone, that comes through mindfulness. That it can uproot everything we know or think about ourselves in the world around us, right? So much fulfillment comes naturally through presence alone, actual mindfulness, not the commercialized mindfulness or the sort of mindfulness of the spiritual marketplace that's becoming increasingly popular and branded and sold to us, but the deep concentration and perceptual acuity of sati, seeing and knowing in the absence of self-reference and completely free of hostility. Completely free of hostility. We often feel, and this is to some extent what I was talking about earlier, we often feel as meditators that we have such a long way to go on the path. A long way to go to freedom. Of course, that's dangled as the highest carrot, freedom. But then we realize in a moment, a day, an hour of concentration, of meditative awareness, we realize that we can be completely free in any moment. In a sense, we're already there. Right? So now what? So with that type of clear seeing, with that type of clear seeing that leads to wisdom, life we find is the same to some extent. Yet everything has changed. Something about the way we interface with the world around us that is still going to be unpredictable and full of misfortune, etc. The interface or exchange, the mode of exchange between us and others and things and phenomena is beginning to shift. And that is the support for that is happening every time we sit down and practice for 30 minutes, for half a day, for a day. So the Dharma, as I understand it, is less concerned about defining or proscribing life, if you will, at the surface or material level or social level or relational levels, meaning ultimately we can live how we want, okay? Assuming our choices alleviate rather than exacerbate stress and suffering for ourselves and others. So the Dharma ultimately is, it's not advocating in any way for a transactional mode of or way of being in the world, but for a deeply experiential one. The ultimate question is, how do we experience our mind and body? That's really it. Like that's the gauge, right? It's not how much money you have. It's not even to some extent one's physical health. It has nothing to do with occupational or social status or power. The ultimate question is how, when it comes to, hesitant to use this word, but success, ultimately comes down to how we experience our mind and body. It's the only thing we can measure ourselves by. So what Dhamma teachings and Dhamma practices are trying to facilitate is our ability to recognize and comprehend the true nature of our experience, what's really happening. Both the short-term and long-term implications of the quality of our mind. So you can ask yourself, how much time do you spend throughout the course of the day or your life evaluating yourself and others on these terms? My guess is all of us have another way of measuring and evaluating ourselves. Right? Do you leave a meeting walking across the parking lot asking yourselves, what was the quality of my body as I was listening to that person give their feedback to me? When we're moving fast, when we're thinking about the past and future, when we're measuring ourselves against others and culturally conditioned benchmarks, we're missing out on something in a very significant way. In turn, when we cut through these mental habits, what remains is the simplicity of a mind at ease. This is the happiness that the Dhamma defines for us. A happiness that is said to be the greatest freedom. So happiness in the Buddhist tradition is not a very Western kind of happy. Like people say, I went on vacation and I was very happy. Or I got a lot of presents for holiday and I was very happy. Or I finally got a new car and it starts every morning with an app on my phone and I don't even have to leave the house to start it up when it's cold. And it makes me really happy. And the Astros won, and I'm really happy, right? And I'm mad that, you know, the Patriots stink. Like, so there's all these, and the Dharma is not concerned with any of that. But the Dharma applies to everything because it concerns ourselves with our reaction to the world around us. So going back to the Dhammapada again, better it is to live one day virtuous and meditative than to live 100 years uncontrolled. Meditation directs our life in a way that we cannot even understand, actually, unless we do it, right? And to do it with some consistency. It is so useful, we are told in the Dhammapada, that a day spent in meditative development is considered more valuable than 100 years of casually moving through our life. Right? So we saw this in the first passage. Tanisaro Bhikkhu says, that means giving top priority to the mind. Material things and social relationships are unstable and easily affected by forces beyond our control. So the happiness they offer is fleeting and undependable. But the well-being of a well-trained mind can survive even aging, illness, and death. To train the mind, though, requires time and energy. This is why the mindfulness of the current commercial spiritual marketplace won't work. Right, it doesn't understand nor is comfortable challenging people a little bit to actually change their conditioning, change their behavior. Right. Through meditation practice, our trajectory in life is simplified. Right. And what I mean by that is confusion decreases. We have the ability to act with less fear and more clarity, more decisively, without hesitation. What is meaningful comes into focus. What is superfluous becomes obvious. In our culture, and I don't think anyone is exempt from this, just given where we live and the time that we're living, we tend to orient our lives around ideas that we have internalized, ideas that reflect cultural values, rather than thousands of years of spiritual wisdom. Some of the primary markers and orienting values of modern life are productivity, achievement, material comforts, increased access to resources, including power and status. Success is largely equated with professional or vocational status, even though their related activities often cause great stress, or relationship status, even though relationships are fluid and impermanent, and all manner of external validation, including wealth or its absence, even though only a mind at rest brings real happiness. There are two more from the Dhammapada. Two more phrases. Better it is to live one day. Isn't it good to know you can accomplish all of this just in one day? Better it is to live one day seeing the rise and fall of things than to live 100 years without ever seeing the rise and fall of things. Because once you see it, you've seen it. Once you've seen the impermanent nature of all conditioned phenomena, you have wisdom, and you are not going to forget that experience. A bona fide direct experience of wisdom is not going to go away. When our efforts in practice reveal the impermanent nature of all things, we understand eventually that this also applies to our own sense of self. It is a sense of things. It is only a sense of things. The self is not what we thought. Through practice, gradually, the self appears to be less and less solid, more of a mirage, a constellation of fleeting thoughts, feelings, and sensations. Seeing this is akin to pulling the plug on our perceptual foundation. We don't need a lifetime for this experience. We need a moment of it. So in a sense, the path laid out by the Buddha so many years ago is in fact far more simple than we might sometimes think, and provides us the opportunity to measure our life based solely on the quality of our mind and body. The Dhamma does not ask, who am I, or who do I want to be, not even what do I want to do. The answer to all those questions are to some degree going to be culturally conditioned. The Dhamma asks simply, how do you want to experience your own mind and body in this moment, in the next moment, in the moment after that? The quality of any given moment is the measure by which to mark a good life or to inspire in us something more. Is this how we go through our days measuring ourself or our success, to use a problematic term. After 25 years of intensive meditation practice and 9 months of living quietly and simply on sabbatical, and after at least a decade of a very successful career as a teacher, I decided to take a job as an assistant, sort of a mechanic's apprentice at a bike shop for $18 an hour. And that has confused a lot of people. Right? And I was able to do that only after having no interest in or need to satisfy my sense of self based on external reinforcements or other people's opinions, and was able to really take to heart the value of measuring the quality of my mind and body as the most important factor in how I spend my time. And so I work in the back of this shop where it's very practice oriented in a sense for me. It's a very quiet space, and there's tools, and I have these very distinct manual tasks that require a lot of focus. I come out of these 4-hour shifts feeling very restored and invigorated. My mind is very clear, very stable. And I notice that under the surface there's this basic sense of contentment, right? And so much of my life before sabbatical was emails and meetings and board meetings and lots of hours on the computer, and I was getting really, really tired and irritable, right? So there's a lot that is possible to us in our lives when we operate outside the self-limited conditioning that we've acquired through our own life, through family, school, world that we've inherited. So you too can work in a bike shop. Better it is to live one day strenuous and resolute than to live 100 years sluggish and dissipated. Now, this is not advocating for a kind of overly masculine efforting, but rather speaks to a quality of intention that contributes to a good life, rather than sluggish and dissipated, which is more of a lounging about waiting for something to happen, like waiting for the life you want, right? So there is effort and engagement required. So in closing, we might hear the Dhamma teachings as a sort of charge or a wake-up call almost. 100 years is a long time. And looking around the room, most of you are about halfway or more there. I'm almost halfway there. Of course, this number refers to your whole life, however long or short that is. So how do we want to spend that life? 100 years is also a lot of time to waste, isn't it? Strenuous and resolute might not be appealing if we look to a dictionary definition, but in the case of the Dhamma, those terms speak to clarity of purpose and skillful action. We have a choice to live this way, constructing our life this way rather than habitually brings us closer to the present moment. And sometimes we experience how everything we seek as practitioners is contained within just one moment.